all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. We're going to squeeze in today's program. It's my last of the year. A couple of interesting interviews. One with a Coast Guard enlisted, and then an officer, Carolyn Walsh, who wrote a book and has had some real struggles in the Coast Guard. I want to tell you about a cool program, that leadership program that the Bush Center down in Texas is offering to veterans. It's a free of charge kind of thing. And then finally, I've got somebody on who's going to explain what is all this Camp Lejeune water advertising by the lawyers about. What did Congress do? So I think you're going to enjoy all of these if I can squeeze them all in. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Carolyn Walsh. Carolyn's a Coast Guard alum. She is a veteran not only of the Coast Guard, but went and did work with the CIA and is currently a PhD student at University of San Diego in the field of leadership. So we've got a lot of areas to talk about, Carolyn. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Jim. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this is going to be interesting. You wrote a book called Fairly Smooth Operator, My Life Occasionally at the Tip of the Spear, and it really brings up all kinds of important issues to talk about, and we're going to make sure we cover them all. But I want to set this up a little bit. You grew up in Ohio. You went to college at California State University and picked up your bachelor's in psychology. I think you played college soccer, if I read that right.
Yeah.
And in 2009, like any good college student who graduated, you said, oh, crap, what do I do now? And you looked around and said, I'm not exactly sure what I'm educated to do with my psychology degree. But some friends of yours were talking about enlisting in the United States Coast Guard, and that sort of drew you into that path. Do I have the story right so far?
Yes, that's what happened.
And you didn't come from a military family. This was sort of an accidental enlistment because of friends and the economy, if you will, more than anything else.
Right, yes, except for, you know, grandparents in that generation that all served in, you know, World War II. I didn't have any military family members.
So I think you've kind of viewed this, and maybe you're the couple of other girlfriends who joined up at the same time from California State University kind of viewed this as a transition to the work world, but it wouldn't be all that much because, you know, we weren't, Coast Guard's not in war, and they don't do any of those kinds of things. So what was your image of the Coast Guard before you went in?
Before I went in, I mean, I felt like it was a pretty blank slate. From, I think my friends and I, we looked up like the Academy website, like the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, and saw things there, made a lot of assumptions that were not what it was like to come in the enlisted route. So at the time, yeah, I mean, I saw them as a service that was kind of spotted around the coast and, you know, focused on rescues, safety, so the environment. So all that was interesting to me.
Yeah, I think there's a lesson learned here for people thinking about joining the service is to make sure you really have an understanding of what that particular service does and what you're getting into. Recruiters are known to, like, maybe fib a little bit, but you were this fit, athletic surfer, runner girl from California, and you thought, well, this is going to be a pretty straightforward assignment. I love the ocean, and I love being on water. But it really wasn't, you didn't really have a lot of in-depth about what the assignments might be, I take it.
Right, the assignments and the culture too, just, didn't have any like clear picture of what it might be like.
And I think everybody who goes into service during our time, we have the good, the bad, and the ugly. There are things we love doing, there are things we'll put up with doing, and things we really hate doing. And certainly in your book, Fairly Smooth Operator, you lay those out for the reader. Talk us through a little bit about sort of that initial basic training, and why did you go in as an enlisted versus trying to go the officer route?
Sure. So we looked, my friends and I, we looked at the officer route and we saw the lengthy application period. We saw that, you know, they only do interviews at certain times of the year, and we were graduating in May and we were ready to go into something. You know, we've been playing soccer, surfing, you know, we didn't know what to do with ourselves on a break. So we're like, okay, like, yeah, we're going to enlist. We're going to learn about the Coast Guard. Then people will have more respect for us if we go into this officer position. So it seemed like a good step to understand more about the Coast Guard before we, you know, committed to being managers in it.
And you had an interest, was it right from the beginning in terms of intelligence, going to school for that and having assignments on that? Or did that evolve after you enlisted?
That was before, yeah. So I saw the intel billet and I had studied psychology and I thought, oh, this would be a great way to apply, you know, what I've learned in psychology and build those skills in the real world instead of, you know, in the classroom.
Well, again, this is one of those things you read it, the recruiter tells you something, is it really going to work out that way? And we'll talk about that a little bit. But you ended up serving 5.5 years active duty and enlisted, and then went back and served a couple of years after going to officer candidate school and being in the reserves. But one of the bad parts of the enlisted period was how long it took you to get to the intel school. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah. So I joined in 2009 and went to a small boat station. And in the Coast Guard, most of the time, the idea is you go to a station or you go on a ship and you don't have a rate or a job for about 6 months so that you learn a little bit about the Coast Guard. I think it's also like a bit of a holding period while the schools open up. So that's the idea. However, the intel rate and then another rate, the marine science technician rate, which my friends are going into, had an incredibly long wait list for school. So there were a number of people during that time who, you know, hit 3 or 4 years without having a job and, you know, building up their career through whatever unit they were at. So they got qualified and everything they could, but they couldn't move up the ranks past E3. So it was an interesting time. I don't know if they still have that problem or if they've kind of, you know, sped things up a little bit in the schoolhouse. That's how I ended up as a non-rate for a couple of years.
Yeah, it was like 3 years before you were able to get in there. And again, most folks who serve Army, Navy, what have you, would be basic and then move their way right to their A school. But because the Coast Guard's so small, those positions are pretty limited, and I think you run into that kind of problem. So that really was part of the bad part of this, but part of the ugly part of this was you ended up at a small boat station in Montauk that was pretty isolated, pretty small, had a very toxic work environment that really was part of the ugly nature of this enlistment period. Tell us a little bit about how you got to Montauk and what the problems were.
I got to Montauk, you know, after boot camp. I remember the first day, you know, somebody picked me up. I took the train in, and I saw him pick me up from the train station, and he was on his way out of the unit. And I just remember he just warned me. He was just like, whatever you do, like, in the winters, find something to do and don't get in trouble. And I was like, okay. So that was an interesting introduction, a lot of warnings there. And then in the first weekend, the chief had gotten relieved from the unit, you know, as I'm coming in, this huge, you know, investigation was going on with the lead person at the unit. So I walked right into that and then just noticed that, it was just this toxicity. And because of the way people rotated out, you know, kind of staggered, it never had like that clean slate to really be like, okay, we're going to do things differently. Like there was always this lingering, just really, you know, ugliness more than, you know, just egos, but really treating people really poorly.
Yeah. And one of the things that you sometimes learn leadership by what not to do, and you got a lot of what not to do in Montauk. How many Coasties were at this small boat station?
There were only about 20, 25. It was very small, very small unit. And our leadership was across the sound. So the main unit, you know, we couldn't even drive there. You know, like a boat ride away. So,
well, it really demonstrated sort of the isolation of this station and how a team, once a team gets isolated, you know, bad stuff can happen with nobody knowing, and that's kind of what you ran into, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Now, we're going to come back to that one, sort of those problems a little later on here, but I want to move on to at least hit some other highlights that maybe weren't, you know, maybe in the good category, not necessarily in the bad, but certainly not in the ugly. You had two, I'll call them unusual assignments that from the outside people would look at and say, man, that's where you wanted to be. One of them was in Key West and one of them was off to Gitmo. Not sure anybody wants to be there. But mm-hmm. Talk to us a little about those two assignments and what things you learned or didn't learn about serving in the Coast Guard and leadership at those assignments.
So the Key West position was a joint interagency task force south, which is a counter-drug task force that covers all of maritime operations that we're doing with U.S. military and Coast Guard forces, basically all the Caribbean, Pacific. So fascinating place to be topic-wise, and just learned a ton about all the other military services and their cultures and their people, because we were all on the watch floor together. You know, saying the wrong acronyms to each other. Had really great leadership that, you know, kind of helped flatten out the hierarchy so we could really speak truth to power. And, you know, I was doing intel at the time, so it was, you know, if I had something I was, you know, had assessed, you know, and it was counter to what we were planning, I was allowed to bring it up and we could have a discussion and, kind of check our biases and really have like rich discussions on what we were doing and the best way forward. So it was a very interesting, like cross-cultural, you know, in terms of the military services experience, and then like really, really great leadership.
Well, and it was, because it was cross-cultural, it's this team relationship that sounds like it was developing. Which a lot of life, a lot of work life is about working with teams of different stripes and types. And it sounded like in reading Fairly Smooth Operator by Carolyn Walsh.
Yeah, it was hilarious and very smart to just be like, this is where I'm going to be. So if you're going to be sloppy drunk, don't be here because I don't want to see you. But if you want to come say hello and chat, you know, out of uniform, like come by. Yeah, it was really great.
Yeah,
great leadership thing.
It is. Did. It is a clever approach. Unfortunately, there was also this may have been your first run-in with military and veteran suicide, but I think there was also a you lost a lieutenant during that particular billet, if I recall.
Yes. Yeah, we lost a really great Navy lieutenant there. Yeah.
And talk to us a little bit about how you internalized that experience.
So he was just a really great person, really cared about his team, a lot of servant leadership, you know, making sure we were good. But he was on his way out. His contract was up. He had been on submarines for a while. And he was in Key West, which is a little isolated, you know, when you're leaving the military. It's hard to get interviews in general because you're trying to time your leaving with what, you know, employers want. So that's really tricky, and it's even harder when you're isolated. He had been isolated, I think, from his family for a little bit. So, like, from my perspective, I just saw it as, you know, really a struggle with that transition process. And, you know, maybe there's other stuff going on as well. But the fact that it came up, you know, as he was leaving, and he really wasn't able to communicate what he wanted to do or where he was going to live. I think because he was a smart guy, people trusted, like, oh, he'll figure it out. But if you asked him those questions, like, he didn't really have a plan or support system. So became really passionate about the military transition process and helping people have a vision and support and a plan when they're getting out so that they have, you know, a little bit of a direction to go in and some hope.
And you found that, the way I was reading it is you found that as, while a horrible situation, you also internalized a little bit about, like, I got to be thinking about my future. I have to not find myself in that same spot of being transitioning out and with nothing to do. Am I overreading that?
No, not overreading it. Definitely, yeah. I care about it with my peers, and then also, yeah, put a lot of pressure on myself to figure out what's next. So that, like, hopelessness, you know.
While in service, and certainly commendable, and more people should do this, is you did work on a master's degree from Penn State, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah, that was a good that came out of the Montauk unit, was that I enrolled in a master's program and had some time while I was there to start it and finish it once I was in Key West. Yep.
This is just a portion of the interview that I did with Carolyn Walsh. She went on to become a CIA analyst for a few years in Washington, D.C. She had an interesting assignment to talk about there. She also talked about, in the podcast interview that's up on veteransradio.net, the sexual harassment problems that she encountered in her service while with the Coast Guard. We don't have time to get into it all. That's why we use the longer format on the podcast. And we really encourage you to go take a look at that. There's a very substantive discussion about that issue of sexual harassment. And Carolyn Walsh's book is definitely worth reading to get her view, a better understanding of the Coast Guard and some of the pluses and minuses. That book is Fairly Smooth Operator, My Life Occasionally at the Tip of the Spear. She's also a comedian, so there is some funny stuff in the book as well as she works on her PhD. We're going to move now to talk a little bit about some of our leadership issues down at the Bush Center. But before that, let's have a few words from our sponsors.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-8255. 4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today, Matt Amadon. Matt is back with us on Veterans Radio. He is the Director of Veterans and Military Families at the George W. Bush Institute down in Texas. Matt, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thanks so much for having me again, Jim, and look forward to chatting with you about really at its core, what is advancing our democracy through compelling leadership of integrity. So excited to talk to you today.
Well, this is a very interesting program. It's in its, I think, fifth class at the Bush Institute called the Stand to Veteran Leadership Program.
No, absolutely. And I appreciate the opportunity. And I think your listeners will, consequences of an all-volunteer force, and one of those things is this topic we all talk about called the civ-mil divide, which is just necessarily that at any one time, about less than 1% serve our nation, and right now there's about 18 million vets in the U.S., and all that means is that the all-volunteer force is becoming more of a family business and more regionally focused. And so we, a number of years ago, 5 years ago now, decided to do something about the civ-mil divide, all under the understanding and assumption that every year, regardless really of the chapter in our national history, and as you all well know, we left Afghanistan recently, and that debate will be ongoing for many, many years, but the Department of Defense every year transitions out 200,000 service members and their families. And so the opportunity for this nation to leverage just the raw leadership talent in our all-volunteer family is such an incredible opportunity. And so in doing so, we decided we can write and do op-eds and blogs about the civ-mil divide, or we can get after it. And I think what you'll see is the Stand to Veteran Leadership Program brings in every year about 50 scholars from a wide and diverse range of backgrounds, but optimally about half civilian who never served and half veteran and or military family who did serve, all under a consistent leadership framework designed to leverage veteran and military family talent in our businesses and our communities. And so, you know, Jim, I honestly think there's not much like it in the country. And I really just encourage your listeners, those who have served or those who never served but really want to break down the civ-mil divide and leverage the immense leadership in that community to apply. And applications are open at bushcenter.org until January of next year.
Yeah, it's a very interesting idea when it was brought to my attention by the Bush Center. I said, man, we got to talk about this. Because I have not seen any program like this in the country. Now, Matt and I have talked in the past about the whole recruiting problem that we have in this country and some ways to, in which to solve it. But this works the other end of the funnel, if you will. This works the end where folks are transitioning out or have been out for a while. You've got civilians who don't understand the military and maybe some of the military folk who don't understand the civilian folks. So you put a 50-50 mix in the room. What are you trying to accomplish?
You know, it's great that you bring that up. After four very successful years, we have 176 scholars, all really committed and inspired leaders who know each other as individuals and as a network. And I think to your point and to answer that question precisely, what we're really hoping to achieve is a network, sort of a collaborative and a community of committed leaders who are just absolutely focused on getting after some of the harder problems in our nation today by leveraging the leadership in our veterans and military family communities. And in doing so, to your point, you know, if we, again, are wildly successful in the next 10 years, well, gosh, 176 scholars will turn into a couple thousand. And just think about the network of network effects there. So we're really excited about this program. It's one of our flagpoles.
Well, this is at the George W. Bush Institute. President Bush has a reputation. The Bush Institute has a reputation. It really allows you to bring world-class presenters forward to these scholars so that they can hear and they can discuss some of the leading issues of our time. Talk to us about some of those types of folks who have come and presented to the scholars.
Oh, absolutely. And to your point, these are leaders who've faced tremendous challenges. And I think, you know, you and all of your listeners, and we all know, in the absence of leadership, you just got to lead. So it certainly starts with President and Mrs. Bush and their inspiring leadership and genuine commitment to those who've served in their families. You know, we've welcomed everybody from former Secretary and General James Mattis, General Pete Pace. We've had former Secretary of the VA Bob McDonald, who also was the CEO of Procter & Gamble. This year we welcomed Alex Gorsky, the former CEO of Johnson & Johnson. Another one, General Al Flowers, who I just commend anyone to look up his trajectory in leadership, this amazing four-decade career in the Air Force, and he started off as a sharecropper's son. So when you look at the ability to lead over time and to lead through challenge, one of the remarkable things I get to do, Jim, is sit in the back of the room for 4 years and hear these people speak time and time again. And I can tell you, it's the best part of the year. It certainly inspires and re-energizes anybody who hears from them. But also, we've welcomed in some elected officials as well. Not only do we look for sort of the inspirational presentation of leadership, but we want to talk about the candid, you know, problems and issues, both individual and systemic, facing some of our veterans and military family members. And so we've brought in folks from the House Veterans Affairs Committee, friends from academia, to include Vice Chancellor Mike Haney from Syracuse University, our dear friends up there at the Institute for Veterans and Military Families, to not only inspire this network of leaders, but also to inform them about kind of the latest and greatest barriers and opportunities to what we want to do.
And, well, this is a great opportunity for up-and-coming leaders to get in the room, rub elbows with other like-minded individuals, have a common leadership philosophy for going forward, but also to, you know, rub elbows with secretaries and generals and CEOs, an incredible network opportunity. The application process is open through January 18th, 2023 at midnight. So the window open isn't all that large, so don't put it off. Where is the, where can I find the application? What website do I go to find the application, Matt?
You come to bushcenter.org and you will see the, come to bushcenter.org or search for Stand To Veteran Leadership Program and it will take you right to the application page on our website. And when, again, I thank you so much. You know, if you served in uniform, if you've never served but are a committed, you know, American and you want to advance our democracy and lead at the community and organizational level, you are the perfect applicant for VLP.
Now, let me put some time frame around this. This was for folks who think, well, geez, there's no way I can do this. I've got a pretty busy life. This is one of these executive leadership kind of opportunities that you shouldn't pass up. And it's sculpted for people with a full, enriched, busy life. This goes from July of 2023 to November of 2023. It's a couple of days, a month commitment. And some of that That's commitment right. is in Dallas, as I understand it.
Truly a network that is leaders of leaders that are going to solve great problems for us in the next few years.
So if you're sitting there thinking, man, this is something I'm interested in, but my company will never let me go, my family will never let me go, first off, it's free. Everything's paid for by the Bush Institute and their donors.
That's right.
And this is the kind of leadership program training you're not going to get anywhere else. And if you discuss it with your employer or you discuss it with your spouse, they're going to tell you, wow, apply. This is a great opportunity if you get a shot at it. So don't get scared off by the time commitment because it's been shaped in a way to deal with the life of busy executives, and certainly there's no cost implication, so that shouldn't scare you off either. Again, we have a longer format of this interview up on our podcast at veteransradio.net. You may want to listen to that, but certainly think real hard and jump on this opportunity if it fits for you. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today an attorney, Mike Cox, who some people may know. We'll tell you a little bit why you might know him, but Mike's a Marine veteran. Mike, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Jim, it's great to be on with a great American on a great show.
Well, thanks. We've been doing Veterans Radio now going into our 20th year, so we're really kind of trying to celebrate this upcoming year, and we're glad to have you on. And let me set this up. We want to talk about what's going on in the Camp Lejeune water contamination exposure. There was a law passed this year, and there's a lot of activity going on so that people know about their rights. But before we get into that, that's what the program is going to be, listeners. You might remember the name Mike Cox if you're in the state of Michigan area. Mike was the attorney general for the state of Michigan for 8 years, from 2003 to 2011. But what you might not remember is that he was in the Marine Corps from 1980 to 1983. He got out, used the GI Bill, and went to the University of Michigan to get his undergraduate degree and then ultimately his law degree in 1989. But, Mike, before we get too far into this, your family has quite a history of service to the country. Tell us a little bit about the other members of your family who have also served.
Sure, sure. And thanks for that, Jim, because we're all creations of the people around us, right? And so my dad, John Cox, was an immigrant, legal immigrant in 1949, came here with $20 in his pocket, and was a journeyman carpenter. And lo and behold, soon after he got here, within like 5 months, you know, North Korea, what's now we now call North Korea, invaded South Korea. And so in those days, immigrants had selective service numbers that made it really easy for them to be drafted. And so within 9, 8, 10 months of crossing the border here, my dad was in Korea with a couple different units.
Welcome to the United States. But I yes, suppose yes. It's one way to make the melting pot work. So,
but I got to tell you, as he told us so many times when we were kids growing up, it was so much better than going back to Europe, which was still wiped out by World War II. And when he came to Michigan, when he came to Detroit, he literally thought the streets were paved with gold, and he was more than willing. So many other Americans have for, you know, 240 plus years now to fight for our nation and to defend the ideal. So he ended up in Korea. He was, on a number of infamous battles of sorts, including one on Old Baldy. He eventually, during his 2 years, rose to be a staff sergeant. He was in a heavy weapons platoon and saw untold amounts of combat, and came back and, you know, settled down in Detroit and raised a family. And that was the background for me. That is funny. I ended up in the Marines, but I wanted to become a Green Beret. And at the recruiting station on the way in, the Marines had the first door. So I started looking at their pamphlets, and then it was pamphlets, right, in 1980. And the gunnery sergeant came up there and nabbed me. But since my time in the Marines, I'm very proud to say that two of my children, have served their nation or are serving their nation. So my oldest daughter, who's now 39, was a corporal in the Marines. So she was with the 9th Communications Battalion and in Camp Fallujah for 13 months from 2004 to 2005. Obviously, as a woman in communication, she wasn't directly in combat, but a number of her friends and colleagues were killed. And so she did her 4 years, was very proud of that. Just like me, she has a Marine Corps tattoo. I'm not crazy about that for herself or me, but and very proud, and should be very proud because we're taping this The day on the eve of the Marine Corps birthday, we'll both celebrate, text each other. And then we have one wayward. I have four kids. I have a wayward son that you know, Jim.
Absolutely.
Who went to U.S. Naval Academy, just graduated this year. Did very, very well, but he made one major mistake. He didn't go in the Marines. So he's a surface warfare officer. He's in destroyer school right now. And he wants to be a SEAL, but he's got to do a tour at sea first. And his name's Rory. Very proud of him. And I have a nephew in an Air Cav right now in Fort Campbell. My nephew Patrick and his brother Brendan was with the Marines. They did two tours in Afghanistan. One when it was very a lot of combat, and the second time around, they had a different mission in the Helmand province. But from the humble beginnings of a humble immigrant, my dad, I like to think our family has come to value, what the defense of our nation means, as you know, given that your spouse was a brigadier general. So I'm very proud of that family background, and so I'm of course honored and proud to be on your show the week of Veterans Day.
Well, I'll tell you, it is a great family tradition that your dad started. Service to the country really has to be recognized and held up as for the importance that it is. And that's part of the reason I could have had any lawyer on to talk about Camp Lejeune and what's going on in the new recent legislation. But I wanted to bring to our listeners somebody who not only has served at the highest office, law enforcement office in the state of Michigan as the Michigan Attorney General, who has a background as a county prosecutor, but somebody whose family has served. So this isn't just a legal issue I can make a few bucks on. This is something in the Cox family DNA that we've got to do right by those who serve in the military. And those who've passed through Camp Lejeune have been really harmed for a long time, and it's not been recognized. Congress has finally gotten around to doing that a little bit. So tell us about the new law and what that does for those who spent 30 days plus at Camp Lejeune during the period of August 1953 through December of 1987.
Well, Jim, what it does for people like me, because that includes me, I was in Camp Lejeune with a Westpac float from the early summer of 1982 until April 15th of 1983 when I got my walking papers. So I was discharged. So if you did 30 days, then doesn't have to be consecutive, but if you did 30 days, so you could be in reserves doing training, and whether you were a Marine, a sailor, some other armed forces member, or a family or a dependent member of the family, if you lived on base, or even if you were a base employee, as long as you had 30 days, from February 53 through December 31st of 1987, you're eligible for consideration under this law. And it's part of the Camp Lejeune Justice Act of 2022, which President Biden signed into law on August 10th and passed both the House and Senate with strong bipartisan support. And Jim, being a lawyer, it's not very often that any government entity goes back after 35 years and changes the statute of limitations. But I think, especially having been at Camp Lejeune during the time, this really cried out, and that the Congress and the president responded. So what happened? Should I start with what happened?
Yeah, go ahead. Let's set up how this contamination got there and how it impacted those who had that time of service at Camp Lejeune.
Yeah, so anyone who's ever been to Camp Lejeune or that part of North Carolina, or it'd be very similar to Fort Benning in Georgia, I expect, and very similar to Fort Campbell in Kentucky. But especially in Camp Lejeune, it's a very sandy base. It's 450 square miles along the ocean, the Atlantic. And so Camp Lejeune, historically, from the time it was put together during World War II, had 100 shallow groundwater wells, right, that fed into 8 different water systems. And And because of the sand, and I'm not a geologist, but because of some of the unique nature, some of the unique features of the geography there, had this sort of bowl system where if a toxin got in the water in any of the wells, it would immediately leach across the base. And so ultimately what happened over the period of time I and many others were there, there were four main toxins, these deadly chemicals that are recognized by the EPA, recognized by scientists as deadly or have high morbid or mortality rates, that leaked into the water. There was, and I wish I could pronounce them, but I'll just tell you the initials. TCE is one of them, PCE. Benzene, which a lot of people know because it's a common byproduct of a variety of oils and gases, as well as vinyl chloride. And so what happened is with the shallow wells, there was three, four main pollution toxin sources. One was, as you can imagine with the spit and polish marines, one was the ABC 1 hour dry cleaner on base, which anyone who went there probably got their dress blues or, you know, their dress uniforms done there. And that was right on the main part of base at Lejeune and Tarawa Boulevard. And they, like many other cleaning facilities in the 50s, 60s, 70s, just took their cleaning fluids and dumped them into the ground.
Yeah, this was real common all across the country. Perchloroethylene, that PCE, was the common solvent for dry cleaning. And when it got spent and couldn't clean things anymore, it just got dumped out the back door generally.
And you're 100% right. So many dry cleaning facilities, and this was a huge one, are much like gas stations in terms of the amount of toxins they produce. And so from the industrial solvents, which contain the toxins TCE and PCE, and this particular, for anyone who had ever been on the base, this dry cleaner was right by Tarawa Terrace. You know, for Marines, the Battle of Tarawa was very, it was a very key battle, you know, in the early parts of World War II. And so this Tarawa Terrace was built. And that's one of the primary facilities of base housing. And so connected to it was the Tarawa Terrace water plant. And in the same area, they also had underground storage tanks, which would have other degreasing solvents, you know, that they use for cleaning everything from trucks to solvents from cleaning your weapons. When, you know, when I was there for my M16 or folks before me with their M1s. And that was located nearby at Hadnot Point for anyone who's familiar. And so, and these, the toxins there bled in into the other water plants. There was a Holcomb Boulevard water plant where the base hospital was. And these three main plants fed not only enlisted base housing, fed the barracks where I was, where, you know, unmarried Marines would stay, the administrative office, schools, recreational areas, and ultimately a combination of metal cleaners, gas and fuel. That there's an estimate at one time in the groundwater, by the late 80s, there was a million gallon lake of fuel in the groundwater.
Yeah, it's been known, you said 1980s, it's been known for, what do we have, about 40 years now that this stuff is there. It took a long time for VA to say, well, maybe some of your disabilities are related to these exposures to benzene and TCE and PCE. Yeah. Congress kind of had to get involved to get VA to pay attention and create some presumptive diseases out of that. But what they did in the Camp Lejeune Justice Act of 2020, which is kind of buried in the PACT Act, commonly talked about as the burn pit legislation of this year, is they gave those who are exposed kind of a new right to sue again. Talk to us about that.
Sure. So what they did is very unusual, and I credit President Biden and both Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate. They created, given the passage of time, they created a two-year window, which runs from August 10th of this year, 2022, until August 10th of 2024. And if you spent 30 days or more and you had one of these presumptive diseases, as you pointed out, Jim, throughout really starting the 80s, when Camp Lejeune became a Superfund site, until there was numerous studies. There's a group of, there's a branch of the Department of Health and Human Services called the ATTSR, which conducted five different research samples. And they do things like compare Marines who went through Camp Lejeune versus Camp Pendleton, or with other camps, or with the general populace. And what they found is 14, actually it's 15 presumptive diseases. And so if you had one of these diseases, and it's a big list, but I'll try and get to it. If you had breast cancer, especially male breast cancer, kidney cancer, multiple myeloma, renal toxicity, which is a name for a body of kidney diseases, female infertility, scleroderma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, liver cancer, miscarriages, lung cancer, bladder cancer, leukemia, myelodysplastic syndromes, Parkinson's, hepatic steatosis, esophageal cancer, and neurobehavioral spinal issues, you suffer from a presumptive disease. What does that mean? That means it's no less likely than any other cause that the water, if you spend at least 30 days at Camp Lejeune, that the water at Camp Lejeune was so contaminated, loaded with toxins, that it is a significant cause of your disease.
Yeah, this is a huge issue. I'm a veterans disability lawyer, as Mike knows, and I deal with the VA. He deals with the court system. But this concept of a presumptive condition means I don't have to prove up my individual exposure and have an expert doctor saying, this leukemia is related to this because the exposure was that. Because of those studies that the government's already done, it's presuming you had enough exposure if you had that disease. So that's a huge evidence burden lifted from the veteran or the litigant, isn't it, Mike?
Absolutely. It's as if a defendant confessed. So the government's confessed on these 15 different serious illnesses that Camp Lejeune caused your problem if you spent at least 31 days there. And then, Jim, there's another group of 15 more that are likely, where it's likely that we don't have the same amount of proofs, but I and other lawyers working on this across the country with doctors and epidemiologists are putting together the evidence that we think that ultimately the Department of Navy and Department of Justice will admit that there were many other diseases caused by that. So what's the takeaway? The takeaway is if you were at Camp Lejeune for one of the 31 for more than 31 days from 53 to 87 and you have a serious illness, you should talk to someone. Talk to me, talk to my folks, great, but talk to somebody and have it checked out.
Well, I want to back up for a minute because you mentioned it, that the Office of Naval Justice or somebody, I don't know who the hell it is, yes. Talk about how this claim process that's only open for 2 years and then you're allowed to sue the government, talk how that process is going to work if we even know.
Well, it's kind of funny. As I said, this has never happened before. So a lot of it, we're working with a blank slate. But what any of your listeners can do is they go to a lawyer, and of course, we'd love you to come to us, but go to a lawyer, and that lawyer, because these are contingency cases, they don't cost you any money, and go to the lawyer, they'll need your DD-214, medical records, which are really pretty easy to get these, with a release. And what the lawyer will do is get a doctor to take a look at it, see if it meets one of the criteria of the either presumptive diseases or the likely diseases. And then the lawyer will put together what's called an administrative claim. And that will go to the Department of Navy JAG Corps out of Charleston, South Carolina. And they're also, as you can imagine, because there's probably going to be tens of thousands of claims, the Department of Justice is going to help out. And they have 6 months to decide to make a settlement with you or deny your claim. And if once they deny your claim within 6 months, then you have a right to go to federal court in North Carolina and seek your day in court. And quite frankly, It is set up to take care of veterans. President Biden and the Republicans and Democrats in the Congress have set this up not to say no and not to give away taxpayer money needlessly, but to say yes to those who are, have been legitimately damaged, which is unquestioned.
And it's much more complicated than that, but I want to draw some distinctions for folks, because our veteran radio listeners are, you know, pretty savvy, and they're used to VA claims, and they're used to claims that take years and, right, and have a very complicated process administratively. But this is more streamlined, isn't it? It's going, and it's not going to the VA. It's a totally different channel. It's going off to the Navy, and Navy JAG or DOJ is going to make this decision. And if they don't make the decision after 6 months, that gives you the right to sue. Is that how it works?
You hit it exactly, Jim. And it is extremely streamlined. You know, it is set up, like I said, to take care of the folks who have been harmed.
Now, I want to go back, though, to now you have the right to sue. You got to have the right set of guys or firm or gals who are going to go to North Carolina and sue. So do I have to get a lawyer in North Carolina, because that's where I might end up having to sue?
Well, I have a partner in North Carolina, but no. As you know, Jim, lawyers travel across the country and try cases all over the country. So I've done 150 jury trials, and for any of the folks of your listeners in Michigan, I just led the $490 million settlement against the University of Michigan for a doctor there who abused athletes. But you get a veteran trial lawyer who can go down to North Carolina and fight for you. And like I said, I have a partner we're teamed up with, a North Carolina lawyer. It's always helpful to have someone from the home court.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But ultimately, as any listeners can understand, the federal government does not want to try all the cases, right? Because juries, when they see what's going on, what happened to people and the poisoning, literally the poisoning of our veterans. That's not a day in court where a government lawyer wants to be in court that day. So we can't make guarantees, obviously, but the drafters of this legislation thought clearly, and quite frankly, Department of Justice and the Department of Navy went along with this. They didn't try and fight it and veto it. And it is streamlined. To get back to your initial point, it is really streamlined to take care of this peculiar problem of the Camp Lejeune veterans.
And Mike, some people see these TV ads about class action lawyers on everything you can think about. But this is not a class action lawsuit, is it? If I understand it right, what you've told us, these are individual claims with individual lawsuits that'll have to be brought.
Absolutely. So in University of Michigan, I had 230 individual clients. Each one of those people controlled their own case and agreed to the settlement. It's the same thing here. Your case is your case. You're not tied to any other veteran. And as a lawyer, whether it's me or someone else, we have to represent you individually and look out for your best interests. And so this is not some class action dodge or scam. This is all about you have control of your case. The lawyer works for you, and this is about you getting your day in court and or justice through a settlement.
Let me ask you a question that you probably get from the clients who are reaching out to you, and that goes along the lines of, hey, I currently have VA benefits. If I file a claim through this Camp Lejeune Justice Act and it proceeds and I'm successful, how does that impact my future VA benefits?
Sure. First and foremost, there's two different provisions of the Camp Lejeune Justice Act which say that you can't be in any worse place than before you filed, meaning you can't be punished by the VA for filing a claim. There may be an offset that can happen, but as you know, Jim, VA benefits are more circumscribed than a civil lawsuit. So, for instance, VA benefits don't take into account impacts on your family or loss of consortium, things of that would normally come up in a civil jury trial. And so therefore, the amounts and types of damages you can recover are broader in a lawsuit than they are in the VA setting. And so the bottom line is, more than likely, if you have a valid claim and you are impacted, this will be a supplement to your VA benefits, but it certainly will not be a detriment.
Well, I find that really interesting. I've seen all these ads on TV about, were you a Marine? Were you at Camp Lejeune? Call me for your benefits. You may have some new things. So I think it's important to pick a lawyer, if you're going to use a lawyer, who understands the Marine Corps. And I can recommend Mike Cox for that, and who has experience in actually bringing big cases on. That's a kind of whole new specialty of itself. So I hope you've enjoyed these diverse interviews that we brought to you today. We can't do this work without our sponsors, and I want to thank again NVBDC, the premier company on certifying disabled and veteran-owned businesses, and our VSOs like the Vietnam Veterans of America Charles S. Kettles Chapter, the VFW Graff O'Hara Post, and the American Legion Erwin Preskin Post, also in Ann Arbor. Without them, we can't do this work. And follow us on Facebook at Veterans Radio. Go to veteransradio.net. You can get these longer interviews that we post as podcasts there. And as always, we want to wish you a Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. And until next time, when we come back on Veterans Radio, and Dale will be hosting the next show, I think we've got a lot of interesting information for you. It's been a heck of a year. When we look at it in hindsight and review it, we always end up surprising ourselves about all the great interviews and all the great information we've brought to the veterans of the United States and through this radio program on Veterans Radio. And until next time, you are dismissed.